Radio.
Matrimonium: How Married Couples Can Be a Light to the World. A talk by Byron and Francine Parola at the launch of the Matrimonium Project in the Archdiocese of Hobart, Australia.
Firstly, can we just say thank you for coming out today? It's a privilege to be with you. Archbishop Julian said that we have a great treasure in our vision and understanding of marriage and matrimony in the church, and it's absolutely true. But the treasure is actually sitting in the room. The treasure is not the teaching. That's really important. But the actual treasure are the couples. And the fact you've come out on a Saturday afternoon, and I'm sure you haven't got a clue what's about why you're here. We're not really sure either. I don't think Julian's sure. We're going to find out together. But just thank you for being here. Thank you for what brought you here. Because it says something about your relationship, even though we haven't met you. So it's a real privilege to be with you today. Who are we?
Who are we? Well, we're Byron and Francine. We've been married for 29 years and a month. We have 5 children. Our eldest daughter married in December, so we now have a son-in-law as well, which has been just a wonderful, wonderful experience. We're now officially grandparents in hopeful expectation soon, we hope. There's no announcement yet.
She is. I have no hurry to be a grandfather. I'm still getting used to the fact I'm no longer a single male. And I'm a married man now. So I'm not in a hurry at all. So our poor daughter is under enormous pressure from mother. She's under enormous pressure from me, but in opposite directions.
And so we then have 2 sons and another daughter, and our youngest son is 15. Archbishop was referring to, we've worked for a long time in marriage education of some sort. We began actually in our first year of marriage. We moved to New York for a year and a half. Byron organised a transfer with his work, and we worked quite closely with Father Chuck Gallagher, who is the priest who married us. He was a very close friend of the family, and he's the founder of Worldwide Marriage Encounter. And at that time, he was working on some new resources, which we then picked up and have carried forth. Father Chuck, by the way, if anybody has been, he was speaking to a couple earlier this morning who had met him, they did the marriage encounter experience. He died a few years ago, but he left a wonderful legacy of magnificent insights, which...
Including coming down to your beautiful state.
Yes.
So, when was that? That was, would have been, 78 or something like that, a long time ago. Just a couple of things about marriage. Marriage doesn't make sense. It's insane in any human, on any human level. I mean, stop and think about it for a moment. Young couple in love, we've all been there, commits the rest of their life to love this person with no conditions, come what may, without no knowledge of what life's going to serve them up. Now, I don't know if there are any lawyers in the room, but I'd challenge a lawyer in the room to tell me they've ever advised a client to sign a contract that had no conditions precedent, no exit clauses, and no responsibility on the other party. Because our marriage vows have no responsibility on the other party. Well, we say them mutually, but it's not I will if you do. It's just I will.
It's unconditional.
It's unconditional. This does not make sense in human terms, and yet through all of humanity, every culture through history has orientated themselves around this. And that's the great reality of God's presence, because you can make a marriage work technically without God being present. But my view is that every marriage that works has God's presence in it, whether the couple realise it or not. Because by the way we love each other, we reveal God's presence. And that's the missionary call of marriage. So we are dealing with something that seems so ordinary that almost every adult, or up until recently, almost every adult in all cultures lived most of their adult life in that way. It's so ordinary. And yet at the same time, it's actually extraordinary. And the job of couples matrimonied in the Catholic Church is help reveal God's presence in that ordinariness. the supernatural in the natural. And that's what we want to unpack a little bit with you today.
So there are lots of reasons why marriage is so fundamentally important to society, and that it provides such a significant social good to the community. We don't really want to talk about that today. What we'd like to talk more about is why it is so important in the church. And I think it's really helpful to step back sometimes and look at the larger story of love that is revealed to us through the scriptures in order to, I guess, better appreciate some of the things that Christ said to us and said to his disciples at the time. We really have to kind of, I think, enter into, in some ways, a little bit of that culture of the time of the first century Judaism. As many of you would be aware, that, you know, in the very first chapter of the scriptures in Genesis, you know, it was really so much orientated around marriage. You know, when God created the human beings, man and woman, you know, the scriptures tell us he created them, in his image he created them. So it wasn't just as individuals that God created us. It was together as a unit, as a man and a woman, as a unit, we best image God. So right from that very first chapter all the way down to the last book of the Bible in the Revelations, which is this extraordinary vision that John had about the end times. And it's pitched as the supper, the wedding feast, or the supper of the Lamb, with Christ being the Lamb and we, his people, being the bride. So it's kind of bookended. The scriptures are bookended. But I'd like to just unpack a little bit in the middle around some of the teachings and the parables that Jesus told us to just give you a little bit of an insight to the fundamental significance that our marriages have in terms of making the Word of God and the story of redemption so real. In first century Jerusalem, weddings didn't happen the way we have them here. Typically what would happen is that the father of the groom would go with the groom to visit the home of a prospective bride, and some negotiations would start then happening with the parents around a potential match.
Has a certain ring to it for me as a father of two daughters. I have a sign up in our kitchen. It's a T-shirt, but it's off the T-shirt I have, which says, it's got in big letters, D-A-D-D. And underneath it says, Dad's Against Daughters Dating. And on the back of the T-shirt it says, Shoot the first boy that comes around, the rest will take notice. So I like this idea that I go to turn. So it's deep-rooted in Jewish history.
Jewish fathers were very, very focused on getting their children married. In some ways, that was his, you know, Jewish father's preoccupation. And I think it's kind of, I mean, I know we're not supposed to kind of take the human analogies and then play it on to back up to God. I mean, the imaging is the other way around. But I think it's kind of interesting to reflect on and say, well, we've got God the Father and he's got a son. Maybe that was part of his impetus for creation, was to find a bride for his son. I don't know. I just put it out there. But anyway, so the negotiations would be going on between these two families, and when the deal was struck, the potential bride would be presented to her, and if she was agreeable, they would have a ceremony where they would profess their commitment to each other, and they would drink from a cup of red wine, which carried with it the symbolism of the blood. Now, you're kind of hearing in this, well, I'm here, but not here, this. I think of all the different things. We think about the Passover and the sharing the wine. We think about the Sabbath, the celebration of the Sabbath every Friday that Jews today still practice, where wine and the blessing of the wine is so instrumental to that sense of connection with the divine. But then they'd separate. At this point, they were betrothed, and it was considered legally binding. And so if you broke up at that point, they hadn't consummated the marriage, but if you broke up at that point, it was considered a divorce. It had to be legally broken. So I don't know about you, but I'm thinking about the stories of Mary, who was betrothed to Joseph, but then became pregnant with a son, and what a scandal this was. And we kind of hear that and kind of go, but hang on, was she already married or not? Why were they talking about Joseph decided to divorce her privately? If they weren't actually married, why did he have to divorce her? Well, that was because it was legally binding that just hadn't been consummated yet. So that kind of gives a bit of context there. So the son would go back to his father's house, and he would begin to build a room onto the father's house that would become the bride's chamber. And it would be up to the father to decide when that room had been finished to a sufficient sort of state in order for the groom to then go back and claim his bride. Apparently,
you were so lucky you weren't waiting for me to build the room.
Oh, yeah.
Because it would still be unfinished.
But I was reading recently that the dimensions of that room were to match the dimensions of the Holy of Holies in the Jewish temple. So within the Jewish temple, they had a series of concentric courtyards. So they had the courtyard of the Gentiles, where anybody could go, and then you had the courtyard of the Jews, like the courtyard of the women, and then the courtyard of the men. And finally, in the very, very centre was the Holy of Holies. And only one person could go in there in any one year. The high priest would elect one of their number. His job was at one time of the year, which we go into the Holy of Holies, which was where the Ark of the Covenant was kept, to do the basic of the maintenance on the place once a year. So Holy of Holies, this is the bridal chamber. You start to get a sense of this is a big deal, right? Marriage is not just something that happens accidentally as a social kind of construct. This is central to the whole understanding of the Jewish faith, and also to the faith that Christ has and built on as part of our redemption story. So once the room's finished, the groom gets ready, and he comes back with his entourage to claim the bride, and the best friend of the groom would go ahead blowing the shofar to announce that he was coming, and for the bride to sort of get ready. While she was waiting, okay, she didn't know how long it was going to take for him to prepare. It would be the tradition to light a lamp and to leave it in the window as a sign of her readiness and waiting for him to come. I don't know, thinking 10 brides, for the wise, 5 were wise and had extra oil and 5 were unwise. And the bridegroom came when they didn't expect. So he's picking up, see, all the stories Jesus was telling. He was telling them in the context of this storyline that they knew and understood. And even the building of the room. You know, 2 weeks ago we had the gospel story of Jesus telling us, you don't know where I'm going, but there are many rooms in my Father's place. You know, he's referring to the fact that he's preparing a room for us in his Father's house. So they come back and they recommit their vows, they drink from the cup again, and then he claims his bride and takes her into the house, and where they consummate their marriage while everybody's having a great party around outside. It sounds a little bit intimidating to me. I don't know what the performance pressure might have been like back in those days. But then there would be the announcement that, yes, they had consummated the wedding, and they would stay in that room for up to 7 days, and then on the seventh day they would emerge and the party would still be continuing. So I tell that, I guess, in the sense of just to sort of get a feel for the centrality of marriage in understanding the redemption story. And as missionaries, I suppose, or as apostles and disciples of Jesus, as married disciples, I think we have a very significant role to play, not just in terms of helping the story of Christ's love and the redemptive story be known, but also in instructing the church as a community in the nature of the way that Christ loves us. So we kind of know Christ loves us to the point that he would die for us, but we often don't connect with the deep, deep intimacy. It's a love that we know firsthand through this relationship we have with each other.
That's why John Paul says in all the analogies in Scripture, where we use human analogies to try and give a sense of God's love of us, the vine and the branches, the good shepherd. He said the one that's most commonly used throughout Scripture and is the least inadequate of all the analogies. In other words, every analogy breaks down at some point, so they're all inadequate, but the least inadequate, the one he points out, is the nuptial relationship, the love between a husband and wife in that marital commitment. And if you think about the vows, and we started this where we started a moment ago, if you think about the vows are our human attempt of unconditional commitment that God has for each of us. We actually commit ourselves unconditionally to each other for life. And if you think about those vows, as a man, as a husband, yes, I have a job. I'm a management consultant. I have a father. I've got children to look after. But my vocational vow, the thing I've committed my life to,
is to love this woman, Francine, as best as I can, inadequate as that is, such that when she dies and goes to God, the closest human analogy she's experienced in her earthly life is my love of her. That's my mission. My mission as a husband is to love my wife so that the best human experience she can have of God's unconditional love is by how I loved her, and vice versa. And if we as a married couple can orientate ourselves to each other that way, will our marriages be happy? Hell yeah. Right? Now, we're going to not do it perfectly, but that's our vocational calling. Now, it's not to earn a good living. It's not to keep a tidy house. It's not to raise children nice. Oh, these are all necessary things, not to be good neighbours, not to be good citizens. They're all important things. But the thing we committed our life to was this thing. And so my job, and Francine's job, is just a means to an end. It's to support our vocation. Our children are an expression of our vocation. So we have a responsibility to them, but they aren't what we committed our life to do, was to raise children. They're a result of our vocation. So does that make some sense to you? So when you start to get your head around this, it's actually very simple, because we're actually all doing it. You know, not very well. We're as bad as the next couple. But we know this stuff. We live this stuff. And yes, John Paul's theology of the body is an incredible revolutionary understanding of this. And as married couples, it's something we should all try and unpack. And all our teaching on matrimony is incredibly beautiful. But we actually live it. And it's built into our DNA as human people. You know, I can guarantee, we grew up in a marriage encounter household, so we grew up in this stuff. But I just fell in love with this girl. I wasn't, studying scripture and then looking around saying, where's this, hang on, no, she doesn't fit the mould. I just fell in love with this woman. We do this. And then we find, when we found theology of the body, because theology of the body wasn't written when we were married, but when we, it wasn't available to us. It was written in some things where we were not. But when we read it, it was like, this is our theology. It wasn't like we read something and said, oh, we've been doing it all wrong. Now we have to do it this way. It was written about how we were living. And it made sense. So we are incredibly expert in matrimony and are incredible teachers of matrimony, whether we realise it or not and whether we like it or not. One really simple parenting teaching that was given to me once was worry not that your children won't listen to what you do. Worry not that your children won't listen to what you say. Worry more, they will watch what you do. Right? Incredible wisdom in that. Well, let's just take it to matrimony. Church, you want to preach matrimony to the world, the vision of matrimony? They're going to look at our couples, and they're going to draw their conclusions about what we say by how our married couples live. And so Father Chuck Gallagher, the Jesuit who did this, he said, until the world looks at our Catholic couples and say, I don't get those Catholics. I really don't. But I want what they have. Until they look at our married couples and say, I want what they have, he said, our teachings will go nowhere.
Chuck used to say to us, that if he was ever a parish priest, and he was a Jesuit, so he was never actually given the responsibility of a parish.
Which was a good thing.
It was a good thing. But he said, if I was ever a parish priest, I'd stand at the church on a Sunday morning as people were coming to Mass, and as each of the couples would come up, I would ask them, on a scale of 1 to 10, how passionate and desirous are you for each other right now? And he said, anything less than an 8, I'd send them home to bed. They're not fit for the Eucharist. And we used to say, Chuck, that's why. But his point was really important. I mean, so often, isn't it true, when we come into a church, into a sacred space, we might be sort of wandering in with holding hands, but then we sort of feel like, we need to, can't sort of display any affection that would be inappropriate in this sacred space. Well, actually, in fact, it's totally appropriate. And we should be approaching our worship of the Lord very aware and attuned to each other. And knowing that he's blessing that union and encouraging the union between us, and to bring, I guess, all the longing and the desire we have for each other to very much bring that and place that on the altar of the Lord. I think it's kind of, you know, just worth rethinking that a little bit in terms of, it's really appropriate. I'm not saying we've got to make out in the church, you know, but we can be certainly appropriately affectionate and attuned to each other.
Aware of each other. So the two great sacraments of intimacy in the Catholic Church are the Eucharist and matrimony, holy matrimony. And you think about the central moment of those two sacraments. Take, this is my body given unto you. And the couple, in their sacramental embrace, take, this is my body given unto you. It's the exact same moment of intimacy. It's incarnational intimacy. So these two sacraments, which seem like a million miles apart from each other, have the same, different, but the same intentional gesture. We take Christ inside us and he becomes part of us in the Eucharist. And we take each other in making love and we create new life that isn't me or isn't her, it's us, which is an extraordinary mystery. It's how we participate in God's mystery. So we have this incredible gift of matrimony, which is so ordinary that we forget its extraordinariness. And it doesn't. The point of talking this way is not to put our marriage up on the altar and make it something untouchable. It's to recognise the presence of God in our lived reality. Because that's what people fall in love with. Some people come to the church and come to God through the Word. That's true. Some people can read a book, the Bible, or they can read another book, and they find God through that. Most people don't. Most people come to church and to God through relationship. They fall in love with somebody. In fact, Chuck Gallagher, who we will quote a few other times today, was quite scandalous about it. He said, everybody comes to the Catholic Church through sex. They either fall in love with somebody
and convert,
or they're the product of a couple's love. So everybody, in one way or another, finds a way. Yeah, almost everybody finds a way. There are a few exceptions, but seriously. So, you know, the state of matrimony, we complain about the state of matrimony, and we all look out there and say, it's terrible. You know, look at all that stuff. Well, what's happening in here? Our challenge as a married couple is to bring it all back to us. We either walk out the door every morning, a shining example, or we walk out the door a confirmation that marriage is hard and marriage is really tough. And it's the same couple who walks out the door every morning with the same issues they had the day before. Nothing magical changes, but our state of relationship is what plays out around us. It's like an energy force around us. And I'll give you an example you can probably all relate to. Who cops it in the neck fastest and most severely in your world when you guys are angry with each other? Who gets it? Who cops the fallout of that first? In our relationship, it's our kids. Right? When we're out of sorts with each other, we're not yelling at each other. We cold war, whatever, but we're tense. And so I can guarantee what can happen. On one of those days, our kids could come in and they could break something that was really precious, and we'd go off. The next day, if we were all lovey-dovey and connected, and they walked in and they broke that exact same thing, we'd say, oh, look at that, there's our favourite thing. Isn't that funny? Aren't they cute? Same action, same couple. What's different is our relationship. And our kids walk around in that atmosphere. They breathe it in. If you want to, we talk about having a sexual atmosphere between a couple. Now, people get a sexual atmosphere and passion. Now, people get mixed up and they think sexual atmosphere and passion means lust. No, lust is self-centered. Passion is Christ on the cross, right? Outpour. So a marital couple's relationship is founded in passion. Passion for each other. A desire to live for the other. So if you want the best barometer of passion in your relationship, put a little thermometer type thing on your fridge door, if you've got your kids who are still at home, and put a little indicator on it, they can move up and down, and let the kids decide what the passion is between mum and dad right now, because they can tell. You can believe all you want. They know, because they are literally walking on the eggshells of your relationship.
Have you ever had that experience, particularly with little kids? Sometimes we'd come in and we'd be sort of smooching in the kitchen like this, and the kids would want to get in between you. And it's like they know that that space between us is the safest place in the world, isn't it?
And it's and when you're sparring with each other, yeah. Not in places sparring, but when you're actually banging away at each other, where are the kids? They're 1,000 miles away. It is unsafe, right? And I don't mean physically unsafe. It's just not... It's not a good place to be. It's the same with everyone else around us, by the way. You know, who's turned up to work on Monday and somebody's walked in the door and they're like, you think, what the hell happened at home last night? Or what the hell happened on the weekend? Because they are just like, you know, radiating anger, right? Well, I can guarantee that something happened in their relationship at home or some other major crisis in their family life. So we are constantly, whether we like it or not, basically broadcasting to the whole world what our relationship's like, and we don't know it. And the problem is we don't think it matters. See, marriage is not a private relationship. It's a public relationship. We got up in front of a church full of people and we made a vow publicly about this because it's a public vocation.
It's personal. Very personal, but it's not private.
Yeah, and so we have a responsibility, even if we aren't doing it well. You know, we know what's important for our kids, but we have a responsibility to our church. You know what? This is not good enough right now. We might be out of sorts. We might want to deal with this issue. But you know what? We have a responsibility to deal with the issue. And I think that's a really important attitude for us to take as couples, because we have this incredible gift to give, this wonderful gift to give, just by simply loving each other a little bit better every day. And you don't have to go and broadcast or tell anybody. They will see it. They will want what you have. And you know you've experienced this, because I can think about the last time you went to dinner with four couples. Right? I don't know, we don't go out for dinner very often. But you're sitting around, and you can picture this in some situations, and you walk out the door and subconsciously you've probably said, weren't Joe and Mary wonderful? Gosh, they're a lovely couple. We're going to spend more time with them. You know, you're drawn to them. That's their sacrament shining. And sometimes you walk out and say, oh, God, thank God we're not like Betty and Joe. You know, man, oh, that was that a tough dinner, right? I mean, you know, nice people, but that's the negatives. Now, we can be either of those people. So as matrimony couples, or matrimonium couples, you don't have to... You can do lots of things. You can run around and do things like we do, or you can... just simply keep polishing the relationship and let it do its work in the world and everything in between. Does that make some sense? Does that sound like hard work, or does it actually sound like, actually, it's just logical and we can do that? Sounds like hard work, right. Yeah.
The good news is that when you're a sacrament, God gives you the help, all the help that you need. And we've certainly found that in our own relationship. This is time for a bit of a true confession. We had a little bit of an argument this morning.
Oh, we don't have arguments. We share strongly.
We discuss with the enthusiasm or something. But just being in the presence of the Lord...
I'm not leaving you.
Sharing the Eucharist, I was just praying, I guess, to let go of the stuff, which we have to do so regularly, right? I mean, sometimes it's daily, hourly. But that's the thing, is that by having a sacrament of matrimony, it's a promise from the Lord to give us the grace that we need to accomplish the mission that He gives us, which is to be, a little witness to this extraordinary unity, this unity despite our differences, our personal differences, our differences as men and women, to find a way to embody, I guess, the extraordinary reality of our God and the love that Christ has for His people. And that grace is always available to us if we ask for it and sincerely seek it.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're just talking about matrimony. You know, we started at that stage. We've got young kids being like two centuries at the end of the pews. You know, trying, because the kids would be up in the altar and they'd be under the chairs. So we'd be, you know, five kids, one down there, then one down this end, like guard. And then one day we says, this is crazy. This is, we're supposed to be a sacramental witness and we're standing here like two policemen. You know? So we sat in the middle and the kids got out and they ran. But we just sort of thought, you know what, let's go to Mass together. It's the little things that sometimes that actually make the big differences. And in fact, I think that's a really important tip for married life, in any life actually, spiritual life, and married life is a spiritual journey, is that it's the daily practices that actually make the difference. It's not the grand gestures. It's like fitness or dieting, right? I mean, you go out and you say, I'm going to go and get fit and I'm going to run a marathon tomorrow. No. You know, you'll injure yourself. I'm going to diet. I'm going to eat apples for, you know, I don't know, you guys like apples down here, but I'm going to eat apples for 20 days and lose weight. You know, dumb, right? But it's the little things you do every day. So when we talk to couples about little lifestyle patterns, for example, we say one of the best tips we've picked up working with thousands of couples is before you go to bed at night, but it doesn't have to be as you go to bed at night, just tell each other, what is one thing you've appreciated most about each other today? Just one thing. As a habit. And I can tell you quite honestly, and this is where real love is a combination of both will and feelings. Right? Real love is intentional. And I know that no matter how busted our relationship is and how hurt and angry we are with each other, if I am honest with myself, I can always find something I've appreciated about Tansine that day. And if I have the courage and the discipline, I can tell her. And if we did that every day, one little thing where we just said, I've appreciated this today, it's not big stuff, little stuff, would that make a difference? And if you add another one to that, which is if I shared with Francine what was the most significant thing that happened in my day, what was my strongest emotion today, my strongest feeling today, if I just told her that, not a great, long, you know, poetic diatribe, just, you know, today I had really frustrated. I had a really great moment. I had a laugh with somebody at work today. That was the strongest, most intense emotion today. And if we shared that with each other each day, which wouldn't take more than 30 seconds or a minute, we've probably communicated, or not probably, would have communicated doing those two things more than the average married couple communicates at a personal level on any day of the week. The average married couple, this is what this research shows, communicates on an intimate level about 30 seconds on average a day. The rest of the day, we're just basically data transferring and project managing. Now, we don't say what happened today. You know, how was your day today? I was fine. Right? But what was your strongest feeling and what did I appreciate you most about you today are two of the highlights of our relationship, you know, of my life and our relationship. And if we shared that, now there's a real, that's why this thing doesn't have to be as hard as we think it is. It's one of the things we try to teach engaged couples. Get some of these practices into your life. So by the time you're married, because when you're engaged, you're all lovey-dovey, right? It's, oh, no, I'll do anything for him. Great, start doing this. Because it takes about 3 months to form a habit. And it's, once you've got a habit, it's really, it becomes second nature. So Francine and I don't do it perfectly textbook every day, but our entire awareness now has been as one of affirmation. Our entire awareness has been to try and share something about what's happening in our lives each day. And all of a sudden you've got a level of intimacy happening. Does that make sense as a practical level? Mm-hmm. So this importance of this matrimony is important, but also there's another layer to this. The church probably... I'm guessing, I'm not a church historian, but probably no time in history other than probably the first few centuries, I'm suspecting, and I'm not an expert on this, but certainly right now in this time, lay leadership in the church has never been more needed. As lay people, we are empowered by our baptism and by our confirmation to be co-responsible with our clergy in leading the church. And Pope Benedict used this word explicitly, co-responsible. Not little helpers, but co-responsible with the clergy, with our bishops, our cardinals, our priests, our religious, in leading the church. And the problem with us lay people is that we have been, I think, culturally trained and are very comfortable to be recipients of services from the church. And that's, you know, I pull my remaining hair out when I hear people say, "I will do anything Father asks."
He's been pulling out a lot of hair lately.
But I will do anything that Father asks. I'm always there for Father. And I say, well, why does Father have to bloody well ask? Right? I mean, that's a childlike mentality. Y'all clean up my room when Mum and Dad ask. No, clean up your room off your own initiative, damn it. You know, with parents, right? You're having these conversations. Well, imagine how our poor clergy feel, right? You know, how many hours in the day do I have to run around and think of everything I need to ask all these lay people to do? Right? And you spend your whole time thinking, oh, we need somebody to do that, we need somebody to do that. But lay people are called to be co-responsible. We have the canonical rights to organise, self-organise, step out and do. We don't need permission. We do it within the teachings of the magisterium. Now, we have to be faithful to the teachings, but we don't need approval to do anything. We can go and do it. Now, we do it as good lay people in conjunction with our bishops and with our, you know, priests, etc. But if we spend our time waiting to be asked, we are actually being quite childlike in our responsibility towards the church. And I know we don't think that way, but that's the way we've been trained. Does that make it makes some sense? I mean, it's pretty confronting when you hear it, actually, because we, you know,
it's quite different actually in some of the other Christian churches. The because I guess the difference in their tradition and their development and so on. But it's very strong in the Catholic tradition, this idea that we're recipients of the services that the church gives us. And we think that's a real shortcoming in our culture and our church, is that we really need to, as lay people, really step up to the plate. And particularly as the number of priests and religious decline, there's no longer the ready supply of workers and initiatives and leadership coming from those sources. We as lay people really need to embrace the initiative and start doing more of these things ourselves. And this matrimonium project is fundamentally going to rely on the leadership of couples like yourselves. Archbishop Julian can give it his blessing, he can give it, you know, a certain amount of time.
And vision
and encouragement and so on. But the energy and the drive has actually got to come from couples. It cannot be. It won't have the credibility if it's not grounded in leadership from couples. And is that a fair thing to say? Yeah.
I work in the corporate world. Everyone's heard of Macquarie Bank, right? Everyone hates banks. Everyone's heard of Macquarie Bank. Macquarie Bank was started off as an investment bank. It was one of the most entrepreneurial investment banks in Australia, and probably still is in many ways, and now around the world. And Tony Berg, who ran it, who I used to work with, the culture they built in the bank was really smart people who are incredibly entrepreneurial. And his job as the CEO of the bank wasn't to tell people what to do, it was to say no. He said, my job's to say no. I want everybody coming through my door saying, we want to do this, we want to do this, we want to do this. And I'd say yes as much as I could, but my job was to say no when it was dangerous to the bank. Now, wouldn't it be wonderful, as an archbishop, if he was sitting there and there's a line outside the bishop's house of people who wanted to do something, and his job was to make sure that nothing dangerous happened. Right? Now, I know, I'm not picking on you because we're here. Archbishop Fisher's the same up in Sydney. All our bishops, you know, Eugene up in Darwin, they're all the same. They're all getting up every morning thinking, who can I get to do this? That's the world our priest, I mean, we were with our parish priest the other night. Same conversation. He's just saying, I don't know who to ask to do this. It's always the same people. And I'm sitting there thinking, you shouldn't have to be thinking about who to ask. There should be a line of people outside your door saying, we want to do something. Now, I want to sew these two thoughts together because that's the calling of lay leadership, and every lay person in the church is called to this role. Now, not everyone is, and not everybody can be, and we'll express it in different ways. It's not always big things. We're going to build new hospitals and things like that. I mean, our biggest contribution to our parish, just to take it down to a grassroots level, is I still think the strongest mass in our parish is the 9:30 a.m. family mass, and it's the lifeblood of the parish in Kensington in Sydney, the little parish. And that thing that brings that mass to life is the kids' church, the children's liturgy. Well, let me tell you how the children's liturgy in that church started 24 years ago. There was this young couple in the parish called Byron and Francine, who were
struggling to get to Mass
because they had three kids at the time. It was so hard with three kids under the age of four just to get out the door, get to Mass, and then have to sit there for centuries.
Yeah. Or out the front of the church with the kids climbing the fence because they were just disruptive to be inside the church.
And we eventually went to Father, our parish priest, Father Bede, and said, look, we can't do this. Would you mind if we took our kids and any other kids in the parish who want to come downstairs during the Liturgy of the Word, and we'll do a children's liturgy and we'll bring them up for communion?
You know, to the offertory.
To the offertory, sorry. And he said, yeah, it'd be great.
It was Lent. We said, we'll just commit we'll to do it.
Just for Lent. Just for Lent.
A Lenten commitment.
Well, 24 years later, there's a whole group of parishioners in there who just think kids' church is what this parish does, and there's a whole roster of people who self-organise. We have nothing to do with it anymore. And it was just this poor, dumb, married couple who were trying to make it the Mass. Now, that's as simple as this stuff. That's still something that's big. It can be done, something can be really simple. So this is not hard. But to stitch the two ideas together, the trick for married lay people, matrimony lay people, is not just to find jobs to do in the church to show leadership, but to also be sacramental lay witnesses. That doesn't mean we do everything together. Doesn't mean we have to do everything as a couple. But if we take our sacramental, if we take a leadership role in the church over here, and we disconnect our sacramental calling from it, then we've actually got, what have we got? We've got a lay man who's acting as a lay man, but he's actually not acting as a matrimony person. And I'll give you an example of how this plays out. On every parish council I've ever been involved with, we've never ever once, when we're thinking about new members of the parish council, said, we need a really good couple. So we want him because he's an accountant, she because she can do this, a great liturgist, whatever it might be, somebody who's got a passion for youth, we want them, or we want a young person. But we never actually look at them, and we never look at them from a couple dimension. And it doesn't mean we have to have the couple on the council, but somebody who's really sacramental. And so we build parish councils without any awareness of the sacrament of matrimony in them. Right? And our couples often don't think of themselves as a couple. They think of themselves as a person who happens to be married. And so we leave our giftedness behind, sometimes mentally. Now, we know is when we work as a couple, and we see this with other couples we work with. Francine and I have sat on committees as a couple. We were the president of the Natural Family Planning Council for Australia as a couple. Now, it did their head in constitutionally.
So to have a couple. Get two votes or one vote?
As the president. How does that work?
Right, of course.
Yeah, which one's going to turn up?
Right?
Which one's going to turn up? How do they vote? You know?
Who signs the papers?
Who do we agree with? Because they're disagreeing with each other. Because we do. Right? But what I do know is that when I'm working with Francine, I'm actually much more pleasant and I'm actually better. Because she can call me in the line like nobody else will.
On the other hand, I'm perfect in either situation. But
yeah. but so without, they take all different expressions, but the trick here is, firstly, we're matrimony. Our vocational sacrament calls us, by definition, to be a light on the hill. And the problem is the light on the hill is defined by our relationship. Not by what we want it to be, but what it is. The second thing is we're called to be co-responsible with the clergy and the leadership of the church. And we're being called to do that as matrimony couples in a matrimony way. Now, we didn't know when we were coming down here yesterday that there was a thing called matrimonium in Archbishop Julian's mind.
Well, you didn't know.
Oh, I didn't know. we don't communicate very well.
I had heard it mentioned once or twice, yes.
But I can't think of a better initiative. I mean, our vision for matrimony is that every parish in the country would have a small team of couples working as a little group to help support and nurture marriage and family life in their parishes, to help with marriage preparation, to be available to couples who need support, to be aware of to be making resources available into the parish for couples. And if you had two or three or four couples who just got together and just brainstormed how to do that, etc. They don't have to have an official title. They don't have to have a... It'd be nice if they do. But they don't have to have anything except the desire to work together. Wow. Can you just imagine? What a gift to the parish. What a wonderful gift to the parish. Now, then I hear about this idea and I think it's got a name now, right? It's got a name. It's got a vision. Is that if every parish in the country built a cadre of couples who were just trying to make married life work in that parish to enrich the other couples in the parish, keep an eye out for them. Because you know this, you come out from Mass, you think, I wonder how Joe and Betty are going. There's lots of Joes in mine. Or we should just get them around. I mean, we don't do it well, but we see the young couples turning up to Mass in our parish. There's not many of them, so when you see them, you notice them. Invite them home for dinner. Bring them into your home, your domestic church. Imagine if you just had half a dozen couples just doing that in every parish. Now, that would change the church. That would change the church. Now, lots of things in the church would still need to be improved, but that would change the church. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Does it seem impossible? No, it's not easy, right? But does it seem impossible? Does it require lots of money? No? Now, think about this for a minute. And I can guarantee it only requires one in every area. And I'm not putting the wood on you folks here, but if everyone walked out of the room and said, no, seriously, but you choose. But if everyone walked out of the room and said, you know what, I'm going to give that a go for the next year in our parish. You all know who's in your parish. You know who to tap. You know, and it goes nowhere, fine. My son said to me one day, I said to him,
how old was he?
It was about...
Which son and how old?
Chris, he was about, I don't know, about 15, struggling age of young boys, 15 or something like that, really struggling with school and things. And I said to him, out of frustration, I said, Chris, if you never try, you're guaranteed a failure. He said, yeah, Dad, but if I don't try, I'll never fail. How often do we live in that second state? It all seems too hard. My dad, who's a wise man, basically says two great things which people shake their heads and think he's insane. He says, thank God for hypocrites, because hypocrites are basically living out a vision they can't live to themselves, or trying to call people to a vision
still,
they can't.
They're still trying.
They're still trying. They're holding out a vision that they can't live to themselves. And the other thing he says, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing badly, which might worry you as a surgeon. but if it's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. In other words, don't not do it just because you can't do it perfectly. And you put those two, you know, put those thoughts together, and is, you know, I think the call of leadership is to try and fail rather than not to try.
That was Byron and Francine Parola with Matrimonium, How Married Couples Can Be a Light to the World. For more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.